Good morning to everyone that's here today. We very much appreciate your presence at this historic event. This is the first time that the Nevada Court of Appeals has convened for an oral argument. We're here in Las Vegas today at the Regional Justice Center in the Supreme Court building, and I'm happy to be joined by Judge Jerome Tao, Department 1 of the Nevada Court of Appeals to my left, and Judge Abby Silver, Department 3 of the Nevada Court of Appeals. We all took the bench on January 5th, and we've already resolved 165 cases. But despite that, we had to pick some cases that we thought were especially significant for the people of Nevada and for the legal issues that were presented in those cases. And we chose the case that's set for right now as the very first case. So, counsel, you get to be part of history, too. You didn't know that that would be the circumstance, but it is. And this proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Internet, and there are also, as you can see, photographers, and the local television station is here, too. So this will be recorded for posterity. So everybody be on their best behavior and make sure you give us your best possible arguments, too. So we will move to the first case, and this is docket number 59685, Michaels versus Pentair Water Pool and Spa, Inc. This is a case with a jury verdict that was rendered in favor of the defendant. So the appellant is Emmett Michaels, and Mr. Michaels is represented today by Robert Winner. So Mr. Winner, if you would like to proceed with the argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I didn't think I could be more nervous. But I'd ask for 5 minutes for time in case there's some rebuttal. I don't know if there will be, but if it pleases the court and counsel. What I'd like to talk about today is the prima facie case, which is about this product, the Pentair Spill-Chill Filter, and then talk about some of the evidence coming in and some of the conduct of counsel, which is a dangerous argument, but I think it applies here, and why I think the verdict came back for Pentair and not for the plaintiff. The split shell filter is a top and bottom. It kind of looks like a big pill or capsule. You got a bottom half, you have a top half. There's a single band holding it together. That design has been around for decades, and there have been explosions for decades. The problem with the split shell filter is its basic function is to filter water, but air gets in there. You can't avoid it. Air gets in there. Now, the pump's going, and you can't compress the water, but you can compress the air. And when it gets compressed and the band releases or fails, that's holding the top and bottom, big explosion. The violent explosion that occurred in this case is something that's happened a lot of times. And we cite in our brief that there were 50 instances in the past 10 years that we knew about of violent explosions where somebody died or someone was seriously injured. We called experts, Manning and Osinski, and we presented experts. The experts' analysis through Manning, who's educated at Yale and MIT, teaches himself, he says, you do hazard analysis. You've got a product. What is it supposed to do? Filter water. Okay. Is there anything that can go wrong? Yeah, compressed air gets in there. And if compressed air stays in there and the band fails, big explosion. Usually happens when somebody's around, the injury is when somebody's around the product, around the filter, just finished cleaning it, doing something, turning the switch on. Otherwise it blows up and nobody's hurt. It's just the way it is. There are two designs, reasonable, safer alternatives that are feasible and have been out there for decades. The first is what we called in the trial multiple restraints. Because he can't stop air from getting the filter, and there's only a single band which can be misapplied. Guy gets it on, it's off a little bit, doesn't tighten up. When that fails, big explosion. So people address this. Stayrite was a company in the 1990s. They were making filters and they were getting sued. They had explosions. So they say, what are we going to do? They designed a multiple restraint. I think there's 8 volts holding the top and bottom in place. So if there's compressed air in there and one of them fails, you still have another restraint. You don't get the explosion up, you get wet and a release of air. What did Stay-Lite do? Well, in the 1990s, they developed this. They took their split gel filters off the market. They didn't have any more explosions, no more claims. They called it the System 3. Defendant Pentair, or whatever they were called back then, I think it was PacFab, bought the company. And they went on, as the record shows, they went on to advertise this filter as the safest and easiest to use. The multiple restraints, there's different designs that have happened, but this design of having a single band and compressed air in there causes problems. Explosions happen. People are using the product. They don't expect it to explode. It does. And it's unreasonably dangerous because of that. The other design that's feasible and reasonable is the automatic air release valve. I don't know if you've ever done this, but on the top of a pool filter, there's a little knob. That's an air release valve. It's a manual. So you clean the filter, you open it up, you start up the filter, and you wait until water comes out and you close it. The compressed air in there is dangerous because the water doesn't compress, the air does, and that's the explosion. The automatic air release valve has been around and is feasible, and Pentair actually developed a automatic air release valve in the 90s. This is the evidence. They put it on a product like the split shell filter because the first design where you have multiple restraints, that's one way to address the problem. Instead of a single band, you got multiple. Another way is, let's get air out of the filter. So the automatic air release valve has a little valve when the air comes up and squirts it out. They put it on the market, they patent it, it works great. One of their in-house engineers, which was in the record, had it on his own pool filter. Worked great. Why did they take it off the market? The only evidence we got from Pentair, and put in evidence, was that the installers of new filters, when you go out and you buy a home, new pool, there was a little leak up the top. Well, automatic air release valve, you'll see a little water because it's releasing air. They're calling the installers saying, hey, I got a leak. So the guy shows up, it's nothing wrong, you're okay. The installers being mad for having to go out on these service calls repeatedly and not getting paid, they complained to Pentair, they withdrew it. Now, Dr. Manning, who said if either of these had been on there, and Osinski, this explosion would not have occurred. It just wouldn't have. Dr. Manning's big criticism is, well, maybe there was a little problem with the air release valve, the one you developed, but you discontinued it, and for at least 12 years, maybe 15, did nothing. Explosions keep happening. The evidence through our experts was uncontroverted. Their qualifications were challenged. There was some reference in there, so, well, maybe they were safe. I saw a reference in the brief saying, well, Manning had never held a band in his hand. Well, he's testifying truthfully. He's talking about engineering principles. How do we address unsafe products? Can we fix the problem feasibly? And yes, we can. And Pentair failed to do it. We also put in competent evidence of their own experts, because my co-counsel in case Workman had been suing Pentair and their lawyer for decades, too. So we had depositions and documents where they're talking about the automatic air release valve. They were also talking about foreseeable misuse, admitting, forgetting to open the valve. That's foreseeable misuse. We know that. Not tight enough, band tight enough. Making mistakes, as people do, forgetting to open the valve. Everything I saw in criticism in their brief of Emmett Michael's conduct is something their expert says was foreseeable misuse. They promised, Pentair promised, we're going to show experts, we're going to challenge all that. They never did. They brought in a statistician who wasn't very strong. He accepted some numbers from Pentair's lawyer and concluded, boy, these are rare. I didn't think he held up in cross. He never addressed the basic testimony, uncontradicted, that this is an unsafe product.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. My understanding of their defense is this. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, that this product is inherently unreasonably dangerous. But in this case, your client monkeyed with the system. He had a positive shutoff valve. He hooked it up to a 27-year-old system. And there was some possible evidence that he that what he said happened. He said that he turned it on and it exploded spontaneously, but he told his doctor that, in fact, he was cleaning it. So there's some evidence of deception in how the explosion happened. So couldn't you say their defense is essentially an affirmative defense outside of the prima facie case, which is we're not necessarily conceding that it's inherently dangerous, but even if it were, your guy was the intervening unforeseeable cause because he did all this stuff and lied about it.
Well, that's how it was presented to the jury, and it was done pretty well. Let's start with the dangerous or risky modification, these red valves. He didn't put them on. When he bought the home, the pool filter was there, and there were these valves on there. You can backwash with them, you can turn them off. They're there. He didn't install them. He didn't do any modification. What he did was call the supplier and say, this is what I got, because his pool filter was getting old and leaking. They said, come and get this. His neighbor was a plumber and knew what he was doing, said, this is how we install it. So he just hooked it up. He didn't install the red valve. But even if that red valve was turned, which is a foreseeable misuse, it's called deadheading. When the water doesn't get back to the pool, something's blocking it, it can be anything. It can be a valve, it could be some small animal, who knows. When that occurs, it is a pressure problem, but Pinto's own people said, that's a foreseeable misuse. Yes, we see that happen a lot. The guy backwashes the filter, which is not quite like cleaning, I don't want to bore you, but you backwash it and you're making the pump run backwards. And you follow all these procedures and the homeowner's putting back together, forgets to do something. They acknowledge this is a foreseeable misuse. Did he lie to his doctors? He was unconscious, as far as you know, for a couple hours. He gets there and he says, this is what happened. I moved in limine, and this is another part, saying, I mean, I'm not the smartest lawyer in the world, but I'm not an idiot. And I see what they're doing. They want to blame him, call him unsafe. He's a liar. And the references in some medical records said maintaining his pool filter or something like that. Well, Emmett says, this is all I remember. I went out there, I flipped it on. I can remember something happening, but I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, he's out. I said, Judge, take that out. They're just going to abuse it. Pinter will. The judge did. We showed up at trial. You know, when they're putting their case on, they say, we got Dr. Casey. He's going to say that's exactly what he said. I said, wait a minute, Judge, this is my first rodeo. Doctors write down or somebody writes stuff down. There was nothing in quotes. And I said, can we take it out of the presence? They're going to abuse this. Judge says, no. So they call Casey to the stand, and he's a nice guy, but he asked him about the maintaining. He said, I don't know what it was. It was something about he's out with the filter. He doesn't remember exactly. It wasn't in quotes. That's suggesting he's repairing it. I tell you, Anna testified, this is what I did. But when someone tries to repair the filter, somebody tries to bang the band, so wow, I just emptied the thing and it's leaking, let me tap on it. Boom. What do their experts say? It's a foreseeable misuse. These are people who are just trying to get their product going, get the pool filter clean. Mm-hmm. They don't know. So calling them a liar, I get it. They attack it. It's almost color Rovian, I thought. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a heck of a guy, very proud to represent him.
Well, Mr. Winter, you mentioned in your introduction you wanted to talk about what counsel did to during the trial. You're almost out of time. Do you want to focus on that issue now?
Let me flip over there. I cited in the brief, and I'm just going to go over that quickly. Witnesses, pool chlor. Pool chlor did the chemicals for the pool, you know, Emmett's pool. He thought they were doing backwashing. He thought that was part of the service. And Workman, who sued Pinter before, said they're going to blame whoever touched it. We sued him. They said, we never touched the filter, never saw anything. We let them out. Good faith settlement. Over my objection, the judge allowed them to call them, and all they did was attack Emmett. Boy, he's making this claim. It's outrageous. On a collateral matter.
Well, didn't you plead negligence, though? That was a cause of action.
No, that was a cause of action. You're right.
And so when that's a cause of action, then that is more relevant as to the negligence claim, not the strict liability claim.
Well, I agree with you respectfully, but on the issue of calling a pool chlor witness who's going to, who didn't see the thing installed, never saw it run, never saw it touch, never
but
saw
to rebut,
injury,
but to
that
rebut.
Is collateral, I say.
But to rebut your client's claim that he had never done maintenance on the pool in the 2 years?
They couldn't rebut that either. He testified specifically, he said, I don't remember backwashing or cleaning it the first year. The second year, I'm pretty sure I never did. It ran at night on a timer, you know. The only reason he went out there is his grandkids were coming for July 4th. He wanted to clean the pool. And when he cleaned the pool, he got the pump started. And, you know, it works the dust out.
How do you Can you explain in more detail how you believe the Pentair computer animation reconstruction, which depicted that explosion, how that was improperly introduced to the jury, and how its admission affected the verdict in this case?
Yeah, I mean, you didn't really have any argument in your brief on that. We're really not clear on what you
started the case.
We didn't see the animation, so how, what was...
Well, it was consistent with the manner in which they tried the case. I felt outlawed in this case, too much stuff going at me. But in this instance, they showed up with computer animation, different colors, red and green, of the filter running forward and then backward. If you have something like that, because it's pretty persuasive, we're a visual country now, I think, and certain juries are, and I learned a lot about that in this case. But when you say, this is what happened, he was backwashing, and then he deadheaded it. That's all speculation. There's no evidence of that. They promised to put on evidence. They said, Judge, we want a spoliation instruction because those pipes that the Gagnon crew threw out, that should have been saved. We're going to prove what happened. And they never called anybody. So they marched through trial saying, look at this. He, FBI guys have the same evidence, don't they? Critical evidence. Asking everybody, of course. And I said, yeah, of course. Never demonstrated this was critical. In fact, Swindle, we read the deposition of their PMK, said, I can know what happened by the top and bottom half filter in the claim. He didn't need that. But it was impressive.
And Mr. Renner, do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
I do. I guess I'm going to go through a couple things. Just 2 minutes, maybe.
Well, you won't have any time left for rebuttal then.
I'll say it.
All right.
I'll go through that later. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Renner, for your presentation. Good job. Mr. Posenberg, could you also introduce your co-counsel here today?
Certainly. Good morning, Chief Judge Gibbons. May it please the Court, Dan Posenberg for the respondent, Pentair. With me, I have my partner, Joel Henriod, and George Stefan, who tried the case. He's from Los Angeles. Plaintiff's argument is based on a misunderstanding of this Court's role on appeal, a mistrust of the jury's role at trial, and a misreading, a serious misreading, of the evidence in this case. There's not much that plaintiff and I agree on. We disagree on the facts, and we're going to spend a lot of time on that because it's not really this Court's job to determine what the facts are. But we also disagree on the legal standard. Plaintiff is coming up here and saying, and uses the term prima facie case. He says when he presents evidence, the jury has to believe him. Now, that may be true for a prima facie case, but a prima facie case is just to determine whether you can get to a jury. I'm not going to dispute that they presented enough to get to the jury. But after that, it's up to the jury whether or not to believe them. We disagree on the standard on that. They say that you have to consider everything as true that plaintiff said. I've cited cases in our brief that say, no, plaintiff has the burden of proof, has the burden of persuasion. They can present the evidence, but if the jury doesn't believe them, they don't win.
Well, let me ask you this. How does that tie into Rule 56, the summary judgment standard? If I present all my evidence and you reject none of it and you just say in your opposing brief, yeah, but the jury has the right to disregard it even though it's unopposed, aren't you essentially saying that summary judgment can never be granted?
No. What I'm saying is, and this is where I was going with our two extreme positions, they've cited cases that fall somewhere in between that say when credibility is not an issue, where there's no doubt about what the facts were, and there's no doubt you should believe the plaintiff's version, then the plaintiff can win as a matter of law. I think that's if that exception exists, and there is a case in Nevada, the Van Duzer case, which seems to say that it does, it's a very narrow exception. They also rely on a New Jersey case, and the New Jersey case says that exception doesn't apply in the garden variety type of case when there's a dispute as to the facts. There's a dispute as to the facts in this case. That's what the whole point is. We don't believe plaintiff's version. We have a whole other version of the case. Here is. There's not much in this record. And you know, I have a lot of problems with this appeal. They, in their opening brief and now in their oral argument, they really present a one-sided view of the evidence. They don't give the court any of the evidence that goes against them. and says that it was a one-sided trial. It wasn't. They didn't, with their opening brief, even present the trial transcript. We did that so that we could show you there are two sides to this case. They didn't present the animation. I don't think they presented this exhibit, which is Deposition Exhibit 54A1, Trial Exhibit 531, which was the basis of the animation that shows the accident scene. Now, here are the two versions of the facts.
Was that document presented to the jury?
Yes. It's Trial Exhibit 531. Mr. Emmett says that he came in, stood right outside his back door, faced away from the timer box, reached in, turned on the timer box, and the filter exploded. None of the physical evidence supports that. And what the physical evidence supports, and what Mr. Michaels told four of his treating doctors, is that he was working on the system and it exploded. He wasn't at this box, the timer box. In fact, it was locked closed in the photographs. The circuit breaker box was open. He was over here in the circuit breaker box. He had taken this apart. He was washing down the grids. That's why there were 20 feet of hose out there. He put it back together. Now, when you put it back together, when you put a filter back together, you trap air in there. And so you have to open the manual air relief valve, which the parties in the brief call an air release valve. So we'll call it that. And if you don't do that, the pressure will build up. But he did more than that. He had installed. Counsel says now he didn't put in the positive shutoff valve. Of course he did. He put that in 1979. What counsel's trying to say is he didn't put it in 2006 when he installed this filter.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Rosenberg. All this is highly relevant to the negligence cause of action, the second cause of action, because comparative negligence is a defense. But how is it relevant to the strict liability claim?
It's incredibly relevant to that claim because we didn't win or try the case on the affirmative defense of unforeseeable misuse. We won it on that there was not a defect. They came in and said that there were three defects. They only argued two here. I think they only really presented a case on two. One was that there should have been an automatic air release valve, and the other that the single band was not sufficient. And so what we're saying is that what the design that we had, it's only a design defect case, not a manufacturing defect case. The design we had was safe. We don't have to prove it was safe. He has to prove it was unreasonably dangerous to prove a defect. And we say, no, there have only been four accidents in an FMS filter. There have been two, they disputed, accidents with the multi-bolt system that they're talking about, the Stay-Lite System 3. We had their witnesses come up and testify. We put on our case in the cross-examination of their witnesses and the evidence brought out in their case. We also called an expert, Dr. Masai, who testified that you could run this filter for 200,000 years before having an accident, and even then you would have to put the clamp on incorrectly. So the facts of the case are different. Under the version of the facts that we believe in and that the jury could have believed, there was not a defect in this machine. Sure, there are other ways we could have won. We could have won on the fact that it was an unforeseeable misuse, that he brought it on himself, that he had modified the product. He put in 1979, the positive shutoff valve. And that positive shutoff valve, we contend, was closed. So that's what built up all this pressure. And it built up the pressure. Mr. Wiener is right. Water doesn't compress the way air does. So there was trapped air in there. And he had not, as he was supposed to, opened the manual air release valve.
Mr. Polsenberg, go to a different issue, which is after reviewing both sides' closing arguments in this case, it was actually Pentar that made a motion for mistrial based on the appellant's misconduct during closing arguments. That said, how would you reconcile appellant's comments in closing with their current argument to this court that Pentar's arguments during closing were so filled with misconduct that it would warrant reversal by this court for a new trial?
I have two arguments. There isn't the kind of misconduct that would warrant a new trial. And secondly, under Leoce versus Cohen, they didn't preserve the issue. They set out some comments. Mr. Stephan said things like, I believe in this witness. But
he probably said, I, 30 times on one page.
I understand.
And sometimes rhetorical, but other times
rhetorical. And he's also talking about their witnesses. He's talking about Mr. Michael's sons saying, I believe in them. It's not the kind of case. The Supreme Court has overruled DeJesus versus Flick for the standard that it used for granting a new trial. Personally, I don't think DeJesus versus Flick had a standard. I think it just said, oh, the misconduct was so bad, we have to have a new trial. In Leoce versus, that's still good law as to what is trial misconduct. And nothing here rises to that level, anywhere near that level.
Outside of the closing argument, I read the trial transcript, all three of us did. There were some things that the plaintiff didn't even cite. A couple times during the trial, Judge Herndon, who, as you know, is not a judge who's known to have a particularly bad temper, stopped the trial and began admonishing defendant's out-of-state counsel for various violations. So given all of that, coupled with some of the statements in closing argument, how can we have confidence that this trial, that this verdict wasn't poisoned by everything the jury saw?
Well, it seems to be that you're talking about the DeJesus versus Flick standard, which is that the misconduct so permeated the trial that it's unreliable. The Supreme Court's overruled that standard. And in Leoce versus Coney, there are four tests to use. One is objected to misconduct that is not admonished at trial. One of the tests is for unobjected to. And the court is clear. And you know, there's something you can draw in Cantorino where Justice Maupin says, there's not much that happens at a trial that a trial judge can't fix. So that's why you're obligated to object. And Leoce versus Cohen says you have to object. And if you don't object, the only way that you can reverse the jury's determination is if the trial judge, and they deferred to the discretion of the trial judge, remanded the four cases in Leoce to trial judges to figure out what to make the assessment. The appellate court didn't do it. And so you have to make the assessment whether that's the only way, under the clear error, the plain error standard, that's the only way the defendant could have won is because of the misconduct. We already have that assessment here because in the motion for JNOV, for JMAL, or for a new trial, Judge Herndon, the same judge, and I would submit he's a great trial judge, he made the determination that there is substantial evidence that supports our version of what happened and that the jury could have made the determination that, yes, Mr. Michaels was working on his filter, that he did have the positive shutoff valve closed, that this is what happened, not their version of the case. And so you can't say that the only way that the plaintiff lost was because of things that were said at trial. And let me go a little further.
A minute ago, you said that your defense wasn't an affirmative defense of the intervening cause. It was that it's not a defect.
No.
How does the positive shutoff valve, his cleaning, the deceptive cleaning, how does that have anything to do with the strict liability claim or your defense of it not being a defect? That sounds like it's comparative negligence stuff.
Well, I'm not saying I waived all those affirmative defenses. I don't think that's why we won. I think we won because three of the witnesses they called in their case in chief said this product was safe. It was a safe product. It wasn't defective. But I could have also, we don't know, the jury returned a general verdict. I could have won on any one of those affirmative defenses as well. But I think this is first person singular, I apologize. But this is a safe product, and that's what the jury determined. So, and I think because of that, and let me say something else, Judge Tao. I think Judge Herndon reprimanding trial counsel is one of the things in Leoce, in Justice Maupin's opinion in Cantorino, that a trial judge can do. A trial judge can do certain things to regulate the trial. I don't think Judge Herndon, by reprimanding trial counsel, was saying this case is out of control. I think he was just getting it back under control. So I don't think this is a case run amok. I think this is a case where there are two versions as to what happened, and the jury picked one. And everything supports our version of the facts, except for him saying what happened sometime later. His original version, his version of what happened when he went that day to Dr. Casey, was that he was working on it. Let me take a second to address that and the pool chlor filters. And then I think I've covered everything that they've covered. And I don't think they can raise new issues in rebuttal. So Dr. Casey, counsel is incorrect when he says that Judge Herndon said, okay, I'm excluding Mr. Michael's accounts to his doctor. They made a motion in limine to redact the history given by the patient. Judge Herndon granted their motion in limine in part to exclude insurance, said, I am not going to exclude the history that Mr. Michaels gave, but a foundation has to be laid. He did not. They say Judge Herndon excluded. He didn't. And they don't give you the minute order from the motions in limine where it's very clear that's what he's done. So at trial, we come in, Dr. Casey testifies, I have a specialized technician who takes the history, he writes it down, but I don't rely just on that. I signed the medical record, so I make sure it's correct, and I went over it with him. We laid the foundation, we moved to admit it. Trial counsel even said this is an unredacted medical record, and there was no objection. They stipulated it into evidence. I don't see where the medical records are an issue at all. And even more confusing to me, the pool chlor witnesses. The pool chlor witnesses came in and said, just as you said, Judge Silver, nobody touched this pool. We didn't touch it. It must have been him. And so I think I've covered everything that they've covered. If there are no questions.
What about the adverse inference instruction?
As we say in our brief, they were lucky only to get an adverse inference instruction. We had contended that this was a willful destruction of evidence. When plaintiff knew that he was going to be making a claim, had retained a lawyer. So we actually asked for the presumption instruction. Under Bass Davis, and really under the statute, too, the judge took the cautious route and simply gave the inference instruction. And really, plaintiff was allowed to testify, I didn't destroy the evidence, I told people to keep the evidence, and they destroyed the evidence. So the jury could have made the determination there. This was a jury case. This was plain and simple, a fact question for the jury. The jury was allowed to make its determination. If it ruled against me, I'd have a tough time. But this is not a case for a court of appeals.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Holzenberg. Excellent job.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Mr. Winner, you can have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
I better get going quick. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. If we put on the evidence in the case of the experts on product defect, it would have been a summary judgment. One of their witnesses said it was safe. We read that in. And background on that, they had started selling the System 3, the multi-bolt, and advertised it as the safest. He was avoiding answering the questions and depositions, safest filter, so the others are not as safe. All of ours are safe. They're all safe. Mr. Gagnon, the pool company friend of his son, Emmett's son, who replaced the filter and put in the System 3, was the safest. Their lawyer asked him a question. You still sell these? Yeah, I do. I don't like them. You would sell something that's unsafe, would you? No. That's not competent evidence.
What about the adverse inference instruction? Is that by itself enough to negate an element of your case in chief?
No. By promising to the judge, saying he was negligent, which I don't think he was, we fought this out. We're going to prove these pipings and the valves are critical evidence. And then he never proves it. He never brings an expert in. We're ready to cross their expert. He's in the back of the room. They don't call him. No, that was abuse. And I want to point out this one thing. I hope I have time. Brent hired somebody to go out and take pictures afterwards. We mentioned this in the brief. 100 pictures. And they said, who took them? So we gave them the invoice, cost a couple hundred bucks. Some plumbing outfit through California he dealt with, I guess, when he was doing CD work. In addition to allowing Pool Floor to testify, I'm not getting much love from the judge. And he says, well, we're going to allow him to call this photographer. I said, the exhibits are in. What's the point? It's just laying foundation. No, that guy told the jury they hired a plumbing expert. He issued a report. They didn't like it. They hid it. None of it's true. You can't even say that's a reasonable assumption. $200 for a report, some expert, it never happened. That's abusing the instruction on adverse entrance.
Mr. Winter, that wraps it up.
I guess I'm done. I appreciate your
time. Just one question. Are you bringing up a new issue about the missing plumbing expert? You say it never existed, and the defendants in the trial said there was one. I mean, how did that get to the jury? Did the judge say anything about it?
No, and I didn't object. I know it is a different standard. I think we need it. I could cite it. I don't want to bore you, but I don't like objecting, especially when I'm saying, judge, don't let them call these guys. They're abusing it. And he says, I'm going to allow it. So he blurts out, supposedly, they had this plumbing expert, and they didn't like him, and they're hiding it from you. So I stand up and say, objection, Your Honor. And depending on how the judge goes, I don't know. But I'm getting a flavor. He's not jumping on something like sustained. And I think jurors say, what was the big deal? Oh, they had an expert, and they hid it.
And I don't know, they used that in closing as well.
I never mentioned
about
it until closing. I said, what does this guy know? The photographs are in. And he had a videotape. He did the videotape deposition. He played it. And he mentioned, well, I work for this plumbing outfit, you know, from California. And that surprise comes out. They have an expert. They hid it from you. Don't trust these lawyers before lawyers got involved. I mean, I counted a dozen credibility witnesses' mentions.
Well, but I mean, the problem is, I understand that every trial counsel has this dilemma. At trial, do you want to object during closing because you're possibly alienating the jury? But if you don't, under Leosi, it's a whole different standard of review that you have to look at.
You're right. And I read the Horton case, and I think I got to prove the outcome would have been different. And you also have to look at what was the scope of nature and quantity. The CSI references, I could have given it to a CSI lab and proven something. Really, what? Did you have an expert lay foundation? No. Promised to do it. Got all that negative inference out there in questioning. Never called an expert. Repeated expressions of opinion, disparaging opposing counsel. How many times in my brief did I cite before lawyers got involved? Before lawyers got involved.
All right.
You might have needed a better lawyer. Certainly better tactician.
All right. Well, Mr. Pleasant wasn't able to address those specific points, so we better stop there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. The court thanks all of the counsel for the excellent job here this morning. This is certainly a fascinating case. This was one of the older cases on the Supreme Court docket, and cases were transferred to the Court of Appeals in January. And so you can see one of the purposes of the Court of Appeals is to get as timely dispositions as we possibly can. So that was another reason why we picked this case for our first oral argument. And we are going to be in adjournment until 11 o'clock, but we're going to do something a little different today since this is, again, the first case. The judges would like to come down from the bench and talk to counsel, shake everybody's hand, and take a picture so we have something for the record. So please stay. And, of course, everybody in the audience, you're welcome, too. And so we'll be in recess till 11 o'clock.